Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We begin this hour on What to Watch with a documentary called The Kingmaker. The legacy of Imelda Marcos is largely remembered by the thousands of pairs of designer shoes left behind in the Filipino presidential mansion in 1986, after the ouster of her husband, dictator Ferdinand Marcos, led the family to flee the country. But during the Marcos's 21 years in power, Imelda took on the role of both international diplomat and socialite, offering a glamorous facade to contrast the brutalities committed by what some call a conjugal dictatorship. She was a de facto head of state. She met with Chairman Mao and Saddam Hussein, businessman Donald Trump, and artist Andy Warhol, all while wielding power behind the scenes in Manila as well. Perhaps this is why the documentary, featuring lengthy interviews with Marcos herself, is called The Kingmaker. Emmy Award-nominated filmmaker Lauren Greenfield doesn't just tell us about the corruption behind the gilded Imelda persona. Instead, she shows us. The film spans a long period of time, from the origin story of Imelda and Ferdinand up to the election of President Rodrigo Duterte. Greenfield provides a complex look at the controversial figure, who turned 90 this past summer, and her continuing impact on life and politics in the Philippines today. I spoke with Lauren Greenfield when her film opened in theaters last fall, and now The Kingmaker is available to stream on demand. I began by asking Lauren how open Imelda and the Marcos family were to the project when she first proposed it.
She's been the subject of countless articles and TV shows, and I think that what was different about this in 2014 is she hadn't been getting the kind of attention that she got when she was on the world stage. Like you said, mm-hmm. she was a kind of diplomat, kind of a de facto head of state as this very strong partner to her husband. And by 2014, when we began, when she was age 85, she was a little bit sidelined. Their opponent, President Aquino, who was the son of the slain opposition leader, Benigno Aquino, was president at the time, and the Marcoses were kind of sidelined. So I met her through a journalist, William Meller, who had done a story with her for Bloomberg, and she was quite open to the idea. I think the stakes at that moment were much lower than they began. The thing that was kind of amazing about the trajectory of the Marcoses and of my documenting them is while they were on the sidelines in 2014, I basically witnessed a very unexpected comeback to power during that time. And Bongbong Marcos, her son, declared his candidacy for VP shortly after we began filming, but no one really thought he had that much of a chance. And what ended up happening was he became the front runner in the race. And it was also clear that it was part of a kind of concerted strategy with many Marcoses in government to erase the sins of the past and get back to the palace.
And elevate the name once again, because image is so important to Imelda Marcos. And we as the viewer understand that from the jump, from the beginning. I was thinking about you as a documentary filmmaker, some of those first scenes, some of her not officially interviewed, she's very concerned about how she looks. Will you describe to our listeners what that experience was like when she sat down in front of the camera and wanted to make sure she looked a certain way?
Yes. So first of all, there's always a coterie of servants around her. So she has a kind of queen-like feeling with many people going with her. Whether it's somebody holding a purse full of money to give out to beggars and people she sees on the street and tips, or a full-time makeup person. So when I sat down for the first interview with her, she's getting touch-ups done by her makeup person, and she asks, how do I look? Can you check my makeup? Does my tummy look all right? And gets that feedback. The image is so important to her, and one of the most powerful moments, I think, of anything she said was when she said, perception is real and the truth is not. She had such a deep understanding of both the power of image, also the power of disinformation, and the ability of to change the narrative by rewriting history and creating perception. It's funny because people always focus on the shoes, and in some ways, the shoes are really a distraction. I think for her, the shoes, the dress, the jewelry, even the palaces were a means to an end. They were a means to have this image that then would have the people idealize her and idolize her. And so she said that when she goes to the poor areas, to the slum areas, she spends twice as much time getting ready so that she can be beautiful and she can be, in her words, a star in the dark of night.
Let's go back to that perception is real and the truth is not, that statement. What is something that you saw or you witnessed in creating this documentary that you think really embodies the statement? Something she did, she said.
I mean, one of the most formative kind of parts in my narrative process was when I realized that she was an unreliable narrator, that she was telling the story and her story had untruths and was kind of an active rewriting of history. It did not align with any of the historical accounts that I read in my research or that I heard from first person testimonies. And so I realized that in addition to presenting her world, I had to show A, how she was art directing her world, like showing her, getting her, asking about her makeup, showing her move the gold sheep, which was on her side table, to face the camera, but also presenting other accounts of that same history that were credible. And so the audience would know who was telling the truth and who was not. And I guess the two most kind of extreme examples of that was the thing that really got me into the story in the first place was the discovery of an island of animals that she and Ferdinand Marcos created in 1976 when they depopulated an island in the South China Sea of its indigenous population and brought in African animals.
And we're talking about, when you say indigenous population, you mean humans.
Humans, 256 families.
Yes.
Brought in zebras and giraffes. And Imelda, for example, says there were no people there. And then we hear from Remedios, the indigenous woman, who says, our family was kicked off and the whole community was kicked off. Similarly, the animals have suffered since they lost their benefactors in the Marcos when they went into exile in 1986 and then had to kind of fend for themselves without vets or proper care and are now into four generations of inbreeding. Well, when I asked Imelda about the animals, she said they were all gone. They were all dead. And then when I went to the island, I saw the animals and I filmed the animals and they were as numerous as they had been when it was created. So it was that kind of truth untruth that was a real insight into her character. And similarly, and in a more grave setting, was martial law, that I filmed testimonies of survivors of torture during martial law, which many people refer to as the dark period in Filipino history. It was a time where tens of thousands were jailed, tortured, thousands were killed during the Marcos dictatorship. And Imelda says martial law was the best time of Marcos. It was a great time for human rights. And at this, and then we also, that gets contrasted with the testimonies. So I think those were the kind of most surprising examples of her trying to rewrite history and persuade people of her version of the truth. Of course, the big surprise that happened in the film is they persuaded a lot of the electorate.
I want to follow up on, you said that you described her saying an absolute untruth and lie. There are no animals. You saw the animals. Is she lying or does she believe that? Or has she been told that or does she choose to believe that?
That's a really good question. I guess the question is, I think she is lying and she also believes it. So whether she's convinced herself of the lie or whether it's a strategic lie, she is very convincing. She is seemingly in her own world. She says it many times. She has been saying these things for many years. It does seem like she believes it, but why does she believe it? It's also very strategic. And I think that we don't give her enough credit if we say she's delusional or she's living in her own world. And I think that is the mistake that's been made in the past, that even the activists who are in the film, Etta Rosales, Mae Rodriguez, when I first talked to them in 2014, they were laughing about Imelda Marcos. Oh, she has this crazy philosophy. Oh, you know, she's walking around Manila. Nobody else agrees with what she says. But I think she ends up getting the last laugh because she very successfully convinces many Filipinos of her narrative. And so I think it is impossible to know exactly what's going on in her head, but she does seem like she believes it, and yet it is also a strategic decision, especially made by other members of her family, that they're not going to apologize for the past, and instead they're going to lean into that that was a good time for the Philippines.
When did you edit this film?
We spent almost 2 years editing it. And basically between 2016 and 2018.
I'm asking because there are going to be people like myself who hear you describing Imelda Marcos, and there's even a shot in the film that is that shades of Donald Trump. There's this great shot in the film where there are brought out reams and reams of paper to and it reminded me of that time that the president brought out boxes and boxes of documents to prove something. There's a moment in the film when she's trying to show you of her great wealth, and there's all these pictures on this table, and she knocks one over, and they cascade off like dominoes. And she just sort of ignores it, that something went wrong, and she just keeps on going. Were you influenced by what was going on in our culture as you were editing this film?
I definitely was. I mean, the two pivotal moments really for me understanding what the film was about was the election of Duterte and the election of Donald Trump. And in the end, this film really became about the fragility of democracy and speaks to the return of authoritarian regimes that we're seeing around the world, the appeal of the strong man. And there are so many parallels between what happened in the Philippines and what happened in the U.S., particularly about disinformation through social media, fake news, through funding a false narrative and putting it out on Facebook and social media platforms. Again, she doesn't hide anything. She tells us everything, even when it could seem incriminating, which also seems like another quality of our president. There's a moment where she brings me in to show me a large, almost garage-type room at our home, which she calls the gymnasium. And in it, to my kind of shock and surprise, are all of the court documents of the U.S. government in U.S. versus Marcos, which really detail the $5 to $10 billion they stole from the Filipino people, all of the banks, the Golden Buddha, the buildings in Manhattan that she bought, including 40 Wall Street that was eventually bought by Trump. For anybody else, it looks like these would be evidence of her culpability, but to her, she's proudly showing the evidence of the lost case of the U.S. attorneys that she won. So I think that, you know, she has that. There are so many qualities. Also, going after the press, she says the gun can kill you only up till the grave, but the press can kill you to infinity and beyond.
My guest is Lauren Greenfield. Her new documentary is called The Kingmaker, about Imelda Marcos. And we've been talking a lot about her, so let's listen to a little bit from the documentary. Imelda reveals a lot about herself pretty early on in your interviews. For example, this clip is from early on in the film, and you're driving around Manila.
When I see Manila, I feel so depressed and sad. This was a little paradise. Before, during my time, there were no beggars. I had a place for them. This is the palace. I miss the clout of being first lady. Not exactly the palace, because it was not really a very comfortable place to live in. But I miss the clout wherein You can do so much.
Imelda Marcos, in her own words, will you remind our listeners how she came to be First Lady of the Philippines?
Yes. Ferdinand Marcos, her husband, was elected as the president of the Philippines in 1965, and they stayed in power until 1986 because he declared martial law in 1972 and was able to hold on to power that way. She was a very unusual first lady in that she had a very strong role. Marcos really trusted her to go around the world and do diplomacy on behalf of the Philippines. He also got very sick, and she was said to really be the de facto head of state behind the scenes.
She was a beauty queen, right? That was how she came to his attention.
Yes, she... She did have a hard childhood. She lost her mother when she was a young girl, and she was the poor part of a rich family, and she became a beauty queen and got Marcos' attention. He asked her to marry him immediately. They got married within 11 days, and she was off to the races in Manila.
And it was to his benefit to have her out of the country for two reasons. One is he feared a coup should he leave, and he also had a wandering eye.
He did, and I think that his cheating on her was really also kind of the next trauma that happened to her. And I think she did love him, and when he cheated on her, it kind of began her insatiable desire for acquisitions. She starts asking for all of these things, buildings, jewelry, you know, building major monuments in Manila, and he says no to nothing.
There are these very unusual scenes in the film where she just hands out money to children who are in the hospital, who are terribly ill, just dollar bills. What did wealth mean to her? What did money mean to her?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think people do get hung up on the shoes and think she cared about that. I actually don't think she cared about it for its own sake. I think she liked giving away money. I think she liked being beautiful. I think she liked being in power, because she loved the love of the people, the adulation. And I think that when they were kicked out of the Philippines, that was a very hard moment for her. And so I think her drive to come back really comes from wanting that love of the people again.
In the film, we learn about, I'm curious how you got people who were anti-Marcos to speak, given how brutal their leadership was, that people were jailed, people were assassinated. How did you get people to come on the record to talk about them?
Well, first of all, I should say, with her giving out money, it is ironic because they stole a lot of money. So they're kind of giving people back a tiny mm-hmm. fraction of what they took. You know, when I began in 2014, President Aquino was in power. This has been a democratic country since 1986, with a constitution very much influenced by our own.
So people felt safe, like they could speak to you.
Yes, it was mm-hmm. a place that really celebrated their democracy and had comfort in free speech. And I think the real surprise is this return to an authoritarian regime starting in 2016 with Duterte. Of course, there is a climate of fear now. More than 30,000 people have been killed in street killings in the so-called drug war mm-hmm. under Duterte, extrajudicial killings. They've also been killing activists, and there's been terrible suppression of the opposition, court cases, harassment by the legal system against the vice president, who's the opposition leader, against journalists like Maria Ressa, mm-hmm. Who have been independent. So now there is a climate of fear. But most of the time I was filming, there was not. I think that the reason the truth tellers in my film were still willing to speak up is because they have bravely decided that it's their duty to do so. They did it during martial law. They were activists to their own peril at that time, and they don't want their grandmothers now, and they don't want their grandchildren to go through that time again.
This might sound like an odd question, but was sexism something she experienced?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't think women were expected to be on the world stage at that moment. But she had a very clever, I think that the Kingmaker idea is a kind of brand of wielding feminine power, that she was able to exert her power through the men in her life. She says something interesting towards the beginning of the film where she said something like, women are underestimated, and sometimes it's to our advantage. And you see her dancing with Henry Kissinger, dancing with mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan. She was able to use her beauty, her charm, her charisma to charm the leaders, sometimes, you know, the very despotic leaders, and get her way. And so she was very effective as a female politician, and yet it's maybe a more antiquated kind of brand of femininity that we would want from our female leaders nowadays.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting, it was sort of a workaround. It was sort of feminist in the way of using all of the ideas about sexism to her advantage to be powerful.
That said, I do think that the matriarch is very important mm-hmm. In Filipino society, and there is no doubt that she is the matriarch of her family, and we see her power with her son Bongbong.
If you said the name to Imelda Marcos to the average person in the Philippines today, what might be the reaction?
Oh, in the Philippines? I mean, there's a dichotomy. People love her and think she was incredible and still love her. The beauty, the celebrity, the person who built all of these big, expensive monuments around Manila, and the person who's part of a brutal dictatorship. You know, they called it the conjugal dictatorship. She was a big part of his time in office, which included martial law and terrible human rights abuses and corruption, stealing $5 to $10 billion from the country. The consequences of which the Philippines are still experiencing now.
Where is she today?
She turned 90 and she's in Manila. She was a congresswoman until last year, but now her her daughter, Aimee Marcos, was voted in senator, backed by current President Duterte, and several other members of her family are in office.
That was my conversation with director Lauren Greenfield about her film, The Kingmaker, now available to stream on demand.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.